Crikey.
Living the dream.
Blimey. I've got a glass of water, and he's sitting there with a Bailey's, mince pie, and a reindeer hat.
And a page full of notes that I scribbled earlier.
A page full of notes.
Just making sure I had a script. And I do, which is helpful.
It's always a good start.
It is indeed. I don't know if these antlers will stay on for the duration of the podcast.
Trouble is, that sort of thing actually makes you quite hot.
Mm-hmm. Why, thank you. I think I look good myself as well.
I'll rephrase that then.
This isn't the BBC Light programme.
Tony Hancock Appreciation Society presents, very nearly an armful, a Tony Hancock podcast.
Hello and welcome to Very Nearly an Armful, brought to you by the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society.
On the podcast, we'll be discussing Tony's famous series, Hancock's Half Hour.
I nearly said my name then. I said James will discuss the show. Sorry.
Just James. Yeah, no one else.
Oh. Shall we all stand down?
Towards the end of the series. It's so close to Christmas. Right. We'll discuss the show, its production, and what we like about it.
We rate and review the episode and just generally get our geek on about vintage comedy.
We're your hosts. I'm James Griffith.
I'm Martin Gibbons.
I'm John Street.
And I'm Tim Elms.
And we're spread across the south of the UK in line from Wiltshire to Essex via Kent.
And our members are spread all over the world. We have members as far afield as Huddersfield, Chesterfield, Beaconsfield and Finchingfield.
The many famous sofas. In this podcast, we'll be discussing Hancock's Happy Christmas, one of the few fantastic Christmas-themed episodes that survives. It was recorded on Saturday the 15th of December 1956 and broadcast the following Sunday on the 23rd of December.
But first of all, chaps, how's everyone's week been?
Not too bad, not too bad. I've been giving a deep dive into the Addams Family. Doodle-a-doo. And enjoying watching some old movies and TV shows and bits and pieces and comparing how they're differently cast and performed and stuff, which has been quite enjoyable.
And I've been very modern this week, and I've been watching the new Stephen Moffat series, Inside Man, which is a look...
I watched that as well.
Have you watched it as well,
this
James?
Week, yeah.
It's a fantastic watch and a real interesting thought on what makes a murderer and could any one of us be one. It was a real moral type of drama, but incredibly well acted and keeps you on the edge.
Have you finished it?
Keeps you on the edge of your seat right the way through. Yes, I did. Yeah. Thought it was really good.
I'm a bit wary about discussing it in case Tim and John want to watch it.
I've not seen it, but I know Stephen Moffat's a very good writer of comedy as well as sort of the sci-fi and the drama and stuff. Interesting. Not heard about that.
Well, there might be listeners who want to watch it as well, so no spoilers, yeah. Please, James.
I'm just trying to think how I could word a question. Maybe
Butler did it, you know. And so, saying, he turned to the murderer and, men, are you skinny? That's how it ends.
There are moments that make murderers of us all.
Bye-bye. Have a good day. Hello. Bye.
No one is safe. From the worst that they can do. Cracks can open in the most ordinary life and swallow anyone at all. All it takes is a good reason and a bad day. Everyone is a murderer. You just have to meet the right person.
But yeah, it was a very interesting, it's very well written, I felt. I think there's some odd decisions made. I think that's not going to be too much of a spoiler, isn't it? But
I think there were some very...
At every turn.
Very odd decisions. There were lots of twists and turns, as you'd expect, with Mr. Moffat. So, yes, I'm a bit like you, being a bit cautious not to say too much in case any listeners want to delve into iPlayer and find it. So, highly recommended.
Because has that got anything to do with Daryl Virtue's daughter as well? Because she was in it or had something to do with it. Because on the end of the first episode, they said... They did a bit of a in memory of Beryl Virtue.
Sue Virtue was the producer, I believe.
Yes, yeah, so is that her daughter then? Is it?
Yeah. Yes, it is.
Stephen Moffat's wife. It's all in the family.
Yes, I did have a bit of a deep dive on that.
Yeah,
and I watched it.
Is it a whodunit then?
I know who done it. The murderer.
So Harry Zimmerman. Johnny Oxford pointed at. Well, it's sort of a whodunit, but you know who done it because you follow it through. You follow the psychology through. And I think one of the lines in it is about the psychology side is any one of us could be a murderer. You just got to have the right situation and the right person. And that's the moral side of it, which I thought was an absolutely fascinating concept to bring out in this drama. Brilliantly acted by David Tennant and all the rest of the cast. But David Tennant, I thought, was outstanding.
Oh, David Tennant's in it. Oh, well, I think I'll have to watch it then. He's excellent in everything.
Yeah. You like him from Doctor Who, John, I expect.
But he's good in other stuff. He was a bit cheesy in Doctor Who back in circa 2006. But, he's been in so many other things. Did you see Staged, for example, during lockdown? I mean, that was great. Him and Michael Sheen doing a little sort of Zoom sitcom type thing.
I've seen that on BritBox or something.
Yeah, I don't think I saw that one. But I remember it being on.
It's very funny.
Well, what was it to begin with?
David Tennant, Michael Sheen.
Well, that's absurd.
That's what I said.
I mean, when in doubt, it's alphabetical order.
That is not a f***ing rule!
David John Tennant, you're going the right way for a smacked bottom.
He's been like this all the way through, Judy.
Now, Judy, it says here, your name came before Steve Coogan's on Philomena.
Yes.
Before Billy Connolly on Mrs. Brown.
Yes.
Well, they all come before you alphabetically.
They do.
So why does your name come first?
I'm Judy Dench.
What is the significance of and?
What do you mean?
Gwyneth Paltrow, Joseph Fiennes, Jeffrey Rush and Judy Dench.
Well, there is something to be said for magnanimity.
David Tennant and Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen with David Tennant.
David Tennant minus Michael Sheen.
Michael Sheen, nevertheless, David Tennant.
David Tennant, notwithstanding, Michael Sheen.
David Tennant and Martin Sheen.
How about Judy Dench introduces Michael Sheen and David Tennant?
That sounds right, yeah.
Yep.
But with David Tennant, I went to Stratford to see him on the stage as Hamlet. So a little bit of culture. Bit of culture.
Culture with a capital K. Nice.
Capital K. Well, I haven't been watching any, I had been watching a bit of TV this week, but not enough to interest you guys or people who listen to this podcast. But shock horror, I have been reading a book, and people who know me will know I'm not the sort of person who normally sits down reading books, but I was sent one by, hold on a second, I just need to check the name.
What's a book? A big papery thing tied up with string. To quote Blackadder.
Yeah. that you put on the fire.
Yeah.
That's a little beauty you're looking for, Tim. Lady, don't fall backwards.
We can't hear you.
James, you're on mute.
Oh. Do you know what? That was a great line as well, and you missed it. I'll leave it for John when he does the edit.
I shall hear back your quip.
I've been reading this book. The book is written by a lady that we met at the Riverside, Martin. You may remember we met Pam Rostrum, who used to work for BFI.
Do you remember that? Yes.
Yeah, and I know she listens to these podcasts. And she wrote a book about the Jack Hilton years of television. And I've been reading that book this week, and I haven't got that far into it. I started reading it a couple of nights ago. But already it's a fantastic insight into TV in the middle 50s and the birth of ITV. And I think in the past when we've been talking about the early TV shows on the Jack Hilton Presents Tony Hancock show, plus the Hancock's Half Hour when it started, how it was all very bit chaotic and broadcast live and all that sort of thing. And the information in this book really brings it home, how chaotic ITV was when it first started, and ARTV, these different companies that were set up to broadcast television in the early days. And apparently, you know, one of the comments was that Jack Hilton thought that all he had to do was point a camera at the stage in a theatre and you've got a TV show, you know. That was
Tin Pan Alley type production house.
Yeah, yeah. No special measures seemed to be taken to take account of the new media or whatever, and or rather chaotic as a result. But it's a fascinating read. She writes under the name of Pamela W. Logan. And the book is called Jack Hilton Presents. Having said that, you might find it difficult to get a copy of it because it was actually written in 1995. So I think it's the sort of thing that you might want to look out for on eBay if anyone wants to try and find this book. But it's
definitely one that's worth looking out for then, Tim. Oh, I think we've lost Tim.
He's reconnecting there. He's moved down to the bottom.
Am I back?
You are.
Just changing positions, Tim. I wish you'd sit still.
Musical chairs, isn't it?
Yeah. When the music stops.
Yeah, so I think if anyone wants to try and look out for a copy, the place to get it is probably eBay.
Yeah.
It's an interesting read. What I've read so far is really good, and I'm actually quite looking forward to getting on with this book. It's really good.
Right, interesting stuff, particularly about production of television, which is quite an interesting and flying by the seat of one's pants kind of story, I imagine. I think I saw there was a programme on the iPlayer about the history of the BBC and how that all started recently, which I watched 20 minutes of one evening when I had nothing much better to do, and that was quite interesting.
Is that how the BBC began?
Yeah, something like that, a two-part long documentary.
Yeah, I have watched both parts of that. It's definitely worth a watch. I think they said they've made it over about the last 8 years, and they've got interviews with a lot of people, surprisingly large number of people, who were about in the very, very early days, obviously 100 years ago. And there's definitely another one that's worth a watch. Should be on iPlayer.
Yeah, they probably caught quite a few of them while they were still around, because I'd imagine there's a few contributors and talking heads who, if they're in their 80s, 7-8 years ago, are no longer with us now.
And I guess that's probably why the BBC started to record the programme all those years ago.
Yeah.
Because with the 100th anniversary, the early people who are the earliest memories were less likely to be with us for the 100th anniversary, if you see what I mean.
Well, yeah. There's a few archives interviews on film from the 70s peppered in there, I noticed, as well, from people who were instrumental in Horizon in 1972 or something like that, for example. So, interesting.
It was a cold, wet morning in June, yet people thronged the streets. A young woman was ready to launch 8 hours of the world's biggest television broadcast to date.
I didn't get the script till the night before. And I was a quick study, so I didn't even really learn it that night. I looked at it, and then I learnt it the next morning, just before I went on.
We got the script here.
Golly.
We'll put your glasses on.
I need them, yes, and I'll have to read it. This is the BBC Television Service. Good morning, everyone. This is a great and joyous day for us all. In a few minutes, our Queen starts on her journey from Buckingham Palace to Westminster Abbey, there to be crowned
Queen Elizabeth II. But it's not only a day of rejoicing, for underlying the Abbey ceremonies and the splendid pageantry of the many processions is the deep significance of the simple fact that the Queen today is dedicating herself before God to the service of her subjects.
Why did you have to learn it? Why couldn't you use a teleprompter?
There wasn't one. It wasn't invented.
But now, other than that, I think the only thing I was going to mention is something I've watched a bit of recently, not that recently, but as a series called Shelley, which was a sitcom from the 80s starring Huel Bennett and Josephine Tewson.
Oh, yes.
Which I think has been compared, which is why I was interested in it, to Hancock's Half Hour, because the character is very much that similar type of personality type in some ways. But yeah, that's quite an enjoyable one. Yeah, it's a bit dated, but enjoyable enough. And I think someone sent me an episode of one which had Janet Fielding, who played Tegan Javanka, who was recently in Doctor Who in it. So that's on my watch list for the weekend, I think.
The Old Abattoir. Lovely name, charming place. So glad we came here. One of the smartest slaughterhouses I've ever had the pleasure to attend. No wonder customers going into a Turkish brothel turn to each other and say, "Stone me, it's just like an English nightclub." Now then, what do we have? Same again? 3 more pina coladas? All those Singapore slaughterhouse things are good, aren't they, Trace?
Oh, the goat's blood cocktail's real gooey.
I'll just have an orange juice.
Oh, come on, Fran, put something in it.
An orange juice is fine.
Tequila sunrise, Trace. First, half a bitter, please, Tracy.
Sorry?
You know, a Kentop sling.
Oh, sorry, we don't do English beer.
No, of course not. Being England, you wouldn't have to go to Costa Brava for that.
I think it was on BritBox, I'm pretty sure, because I saw an episode in the last 6 months of Shelley. And I sorted out because it was one I used to watch back in the day and quite enjoyed it. But I did think it was rather dated now, and I didn't go on with it after having seen one episode or so.
Yeah, it's a little bit more topical, I suppose, than a lot of other comedy shows, because there's sort of a little bit of political story behind it, I think, to some extent or another, in terms of the way society is quite different to it was in the early 80s. I think it's early 80s, isn't it?
How's it going?
Hmm?
The bills.
It's not the poverty I mind, it's the paperwork. Well, I mind the poverty as well. You ever considered selling your body on the streets? I mean, I'd sell mine, but there's not the demand.
How much are we short?
About £18.50, according to this. Could always charge £20, cover expenses.
And now, time for our main subject, Hancock's Happy Christmas. So what did you think of this one, guys?
This was the first time I've listened to it for a very long time. And it was a joy, because I've forgotten how good it actually was.
You mean you don't get it out every Christmas, James?
Well, no, I'd normally listen to The Christmas Club or something like that, but it's been such a long time, because I didn't actually have this one in my collection for some reason. I got it off Spotify to listen to it, and I was laughing all the way through. It's just such a good episode. I think it's performed really well. Am I right in thinking that previously the actor who plays the little boy, have we been in touch with him before? And am I right in thinking that?
We have indeed, yes. His name is Michael Anderson Jr. He was just Michael Anderson when he appeared with Hancock. And he was 12 years old when he appeared in this program as one of the two orphans who get to stay with Hancock. And I got in touch with him, when was it? About 18 months ago, I think it was now, first of all, to try and jog his memory about his appearance. And in fact, we exchanged emails quite recently as well. Unfortunately, he hasn't been very well lately, but he wishes everyone in the society and all our listeners a very happy Christmas. And we hope he gets better soon. Yes, yeah, so he and a young girl, whose name escapes me,
Dorothy Marks, I think.
So Michael and Dorothy Marks played the two orphans. And he was about 12 or 13 years old or whatever when he did this. And he was at a drama school and got the gig through that. But I think most people think, really, that the two kids stole the show.
Oh, definitely.
Very, absolutely.
Very professional performance. I think I've mentioned this before when this cropped up once before on a podcast. We did an article about it in our Society magazine, the Missing Page, that his memory is that when he went on the stage to do this and went through the curtain, as it were, that was the first time he had met Hancock, Sid and Hattie. He is adamant that they did not get a rehearsal and they just went straight in and did it.
Staggering.
It is staggering. I mean, several things. First of all, it was an awful long time ago. And, you know, with all due respect to Michael, I think people's memories can be play tricks on themselves. But I actually went back to him in this. I said, Michael, this would be incredibly unusual. A rehearsal was listed on the script. It says there was a rehearsal. There would have always been a read-through and rehearsal, without a doubt. I just find it difficult to understand how all the adults could get round and have a rehearsal and not include the two youngsters who would make or break the program.
Seems unlikely.
But I went back to him on this and said, Michael, are you sure? And he says, absolutely, that's what I remember.
Oh, that would be the children.
I'll go.
Mr. Hancock?
Yes?
We're the orphans.
Merry Christmas, where's the pudding? I do hate suspicious kids. Now go on, get in the living room and sit down.
Where's the telly?
We haven't got one.
Michael, I'll get the coats, you get the food, and we'll get the bus back to the orphanage.
You stay where you are. Why did I have to get a couple of kids like you two?
Because all the kids in the home tossed up and we lost.
Ah, very funny. Wait till you see your room.
And he remembers going through the curtain, getting a round of applause or whatever, and going straight into it. He said they were very good to him and all that sort of thing, you know. But having said that, you know, some crazy things happened back then, didn't they?
Yeah.
You know, we said this before. So I was looking at the script earlier, and scripts, as you know, give rehearsal times and broadcast times and all that. And it says that this was being recorded at 9:30 in the evening. But all it says for rehearsal is final call at 8:15. That's only an hour and a quarter before the recording starts. Now, that again is not unusual, because we've had evidence from that guy in the Poetry Society, haven't they, that they all turned up just before and they didn't even know what part they were going to play until an hour and a half before the radio show started. So these things were done at the last minute, and it was quite usual for people, you know, professionals like Hattie Jakes and Sid James and Hancock and that, to be able to just pick up a script and run with it. But I still find it incredible that a couple of child actors would be thrown in the deep end like that.
Especially the bit in there where they keep sort of calling back to, "We're going to tell the vicar." And especially when they all say, "We're going to tell the vicar."
Yeah.
It just sounds like they would have practiced that, because it was
perfect timing, wasn't it?
Yeah.
"Listen, Fatty, if you don't let us have all the stuff in that sack..."
"Don't tell me."
We're going to tell the vicar.
"Yes. It would appear you two have got me... how can I word it?
Up the creek?"
"Well put."
Michael said, I think, that they'd probably had the script in advance. I mean, if he's a member of a drama school, it wouldn't surprise me if the drama school teachers had gone through it with them, etc. You know, if two of their students were going on a top radio show, they'd probably have some input into that. Absolutely. But their timing was impeccable.
Oh, yeah, spot on.
And the interaction between the boy, Michael, and Hancock was superb. You know, that bit where he says, you know, "I'll scratch your back and you'll scratch mine" type thing. I mean, that was just, you know, it was just so natural and so brilliantly timed.
"This is the living room."
"Cool, what a dump." "Even the orphanage was better than this."
"Now listen, Titch. I think you and I better have a little talk. I don't like the way things are shaping. Let's start now as we mean to go on. You scratch my back, and I'll scratch yours. You be nice to me, and I'll be nice to you. You cause trouble for me, I cause trouble for you, right?"
"Right."
"What about the 5 quid?
Yeah, the timing was brilliant, and the little sequence where it talks about Bill being a foreigner.
"Where's your pouch?"
And he says, "Where's your pouch?" And Bill says, "You're getting me confused with these animals with big feet and little heads."
Yeah.
And immediately he comes back with, "Where's your pouch again?" But the timing of it was absolutely perfect.
Yeah.
Plays an excellent street urchin, doesn't he, kind of character. He's sort of cheeky, but he's great with it.
Yeah.
"Kiddo, I don't trust him. Did you hear that accent? He's a foreigner."
"I'm not. I'm Australian."
"Where's your pouch?"
"I haven't got a pouch. You're getting me mixed up with a kangaroo."
"Oh, you mean those funny-looking animals with tiny heads and big feet?"
"Yeah, that's them."
"Where's your pouch?"
That's the thing. I mean, I wonder if perhaps maybe they got to the theatre and they had a run-through and then they performed it, and the rehearsal was literally half an hour before it, possibly due to the fact the kids would have been at school.
I think it was at the weekend, but they wouldn't have done the rehearsal much earlier than that. They wouldn't have got Hancock and people along the day before or lunchtime or something. It was quite normal to turn up a couple of hours before the programme, have a read through, then go and do it in the in front of the mics.
Yeah.
Then, you know, we've been told they all disappeared down the pub, come back for perhaps another read through or straight on with the show. I mean, that's how it was done. But I think it's a bit different from seasoned professionals to school kids, you know. That's, I think, the difference. He had a great career because his dad was a film director, Michael Anderson, Sr., and he made movies like Logan's Run, Around the World in 80 Days, and he did the Dam Busters as well, in which Bill Kerr played the bomber, of course.
He did.
And the funny thing was, because Michael Anderson Jr., came from Uxbridge, which is where my in-laws are from. But he went from Uxbridge to Hollywood, and he still lives in the United States now. He went out there to make films and stuff. And he made his career as a cowboy. And, you know, he was the cowboy from Uxbridge. And he was in a number of westerns and stuff.
"I'm going to get that guy. Who wants to come with me?"
"You're not going any place."
"Oh, you're going to try and stop me?"
"You bet I am." and that's for sure.
Bud, the kid, who had to be taught what it meant to be an elder and a man.
John, this guy just called Pa a liar and a drunk. That invitation to pick up a gun still holds for Johnny Elder.
He was also in a film called Cast Away with Hayley Mills. And he'd worked with John Wayne and Peter Ustinov and Robert Mitchum and all these top actors, you know, he's worked with during his career. And needless to say, you know, this little thing he did for Hancock back when he was 12 is but a distant memory. He says it's a wonderful memory and he keeps it locked away. And, he said, but I think at the end of the day, he can't remember much about it any more than Laurie Webb can or any of the other people, you know, we've often been in touch with.
It's such a long time ago, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Can you remember much from when you were 12? That's the thing, you know, I certainly can't.
It's funny because I actually appeared on stage when I was 12 because I was a Brussel, as my dad used to call me, a Brussel Sprout, a Boy Scout. And I was brought up in Hastings and our local Scout Association put on the gang show at the local theatre, following in Hancock's footsteps, of course. And so we did our own Scout gang show. We did several years. I think it went on for many years after I did it, but I was in the first one and probably the second one as well. I've got a picture somewhere that someone sent me in recent years.
I'm sure someone will do a podcast about that one day, Tim.
But, you know, the reason I mention that is because, you know, it's the same sort of thing. What do I remember of that now? You know, I mean, it's just something we did at school when in the Scouts, you know, when I was that the same sort of age as Michael Anderson was when he did this. And yes, there's a couple of things about it I remember, but I don't remember the rehearsal schedule and all that sort of stuff. I mean, you know, I remember when someone fell over on the stage and things like that, you know, but it's those sorts of things, you know. And
that's the sort of things that stick in your mind, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah. And I remember looking into the audience and seeing one of the kids out of my class and being hugely embarrassed by it. But, you know, but apart from that, actually, having said that, I still remember the words of one of the songs we had to sing. But hey.
God, you can't say that and then not give us a rendition, Tim.
Oh, yes, I can.
Probably for the best.
We did a little sketch thing called the Disc Buyers, which was about youngsters buying records. So we all had to line up in front of the curtain and sing this song. And I still remember it now, but no, I'm not going to do it, I'm afraid.
It's a sort of slower open, this episode, isn't it? You're sort of mumbling out and complaining about it. I'm not having pinholes all over my ceiling. I've just had this room done out.
I spent 30 bob having this room done out, and I'm not having it. I'm not having pinholes all over it.
Well, at least we can have a tree.
We are not having a tree.
Which is sort of my reaction to sticking things in the ceiling now that I own the ceiling. But yeah, that kind of stroppy kind of W.C. Fields Dickensian open is quite entertaining.
Bah, humbug.
Bah, humbug. I hate Christmas.
This is Hancock at his Scrooge best, isn't it?
Yes, absolutely. Mm. Yeah.
I would think it's probably his most miserable performance.
His most Scroogey moment.
Most Scroogey performance in any of the half hours, isn't it?
Yeah, like the lovely line, "Oh, what a nasty man I am." That's great.
Not so much of the old lip. Now get your stock in and put the money in it, right?
Right.
Good night.
Good night. Good night.
What a nasty man I am.
Yeah, and you can just see him doing what you were just doing then, John, rubbing his hands together and saying, yes.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
But I think there's what he plays that part so well, though, doesn't he?
He does,
The pure misery is just brilliant.
It's something he could do quite well, actually, isn't it? I mean, it comes right through. I mean, I don't think it's a trait from real life that Gordon Simpson picked up on. I just think it's something he was able to do very good as an actor to do this, and it comes across brilliantly. I love one of the opening lines when he talks about, you know, you're not going to have any dinner. It's egg and chips, a mug of cocoa, and straight up to bed.
Egg and chips, a mug of cocoa, and straight up to bed. That's me.
Oh, but Tubby,
I have spoken. Do you mind? Christmas is going to be just like any other day in this house. Dead miserable.
Now you mentioned egg. Just going to talk about Polish eggs. Do you know Polish eggs?
Come on, these very young chickens in shells.
Yeah, got shells in them.
In shells, yes.
Highly seasoned food like turkeys and puddings is not for young stomachs like yours. We've got some young chickens for you. Very young chickens.
Oh, good.
They're Polish with shells round them.
Do you ever have Polish eggs?
Well, I tried looking this up once before. I can only assume.
I can tell you.
You can.
Well, I'm a chef by trade.
Go on then, chef.
So it's the egg boiled and then taken out and like mixed with mayonnaise and breadcrumbs and herbs and then put back in the shell.
Oh.
So it's like it was a bit of a cheap dinner.
Really?
It's almost like egg mayonnaise, yeah. But it back in the shell and then possibly baked.
So was that popular back in the 50s then?
I think even right through to the 80s, because I can remember my grandparents used to eat them quite a lot. I don't really like eggs, but I can remember them being around. Yeah.
But had they been around as far back as the 50s?
Yeah, it was a bit of a staple, I think, maybe during the war and stuff like that, when rations were on, it was a bit of a make a meal up out of this, you know, especially when people maybe having their own chickens and stuff like that to try and...
So why were they called Polish eggs?
Don't know why they were called Polish eggs.
Perhaps it was a dish that had originated then in Poland. When I looked up Polish eggs as a research for doing this podcast, all I could find was the beautifully decorated Polish eggs for Easter, which looked absolutely amazing. But I thought, that's not going to be what Tony's referring to here.
I thought it was literally eggs from Poland until it sort of dawned on me that, yeah, Polish eggs, I remember that. I remember that in my early years.
In your chef training days.
Yeah, I think doing college courses and stuff like that, I can kind of remember.
There's a few interesting recipes that crop up in this one.
Can I just say, this is the first time that James has told us about a topical reference.
Normally it's the other way around.
Normally he's asking us what the topical references are.
Well, same take into season 4. Do you see how smart I got? I got nothing else, by the way.
That's it, you're spent now.
I'm off now. See you later.
Ta-ra. But there's like the moment where Hattie's, where's the chicken? There it is behind that spud.
Well, we're all set. Bring on the turkey.
Sydney, bring the turkey in.
Here it is. Where? On the plate, just there, behind that spud.
That was an 18-pound turkey when it started.
Oh, the turkey, yeah.
And then you got the lovely sound effect of them soaring through some wood, which is supposed to be them trying to carve this chicken.
Oh, well, what's done is done. Let's get on with the carving. Here, you have a go. Oh, don't bother. Varnish it and stick it on the roof. I've always wanted a weathercock.
But her description of why she had to keep taking it out of the oven, because his feathers kept catching a light. It's just such a funny idea. And they do make jokes about Hattie's, Miss Pew's inability to cook repeatedly, but this is one of the better ones, I think.
Miss Pew, what have you been doing? You said you could cook.
It's frizzled up, that's all. It wasn't my fault. While I was cooking it, I had to keep taking it out of the oven.
Why?
Its feathers kept catching a light.
I love the fact that she put the Christmas pudding in the pressure cooker. And it
last
was last
seen flying towards Brixton.
Brixton.
Well, I was going to tell you about that.
What has happened to the Christmas pudding?
I don't know. I put it in the pressure cooker, turned the gas up, and the last time I saw it was heading towards Brixton.
That's a good one. And she gets some good lines in here. I mean, there's a speech early on in it where she's going about all that peace and goodwill to all men, and then Tony's reaction to it.
This is the time of a year when one should open one's heart to one's fellow beings. The time to forgive one's enemies. Peace on earth and goodwill to all men. The time...
That's it. Go on, girl. Have a go. Look at her, the spirit of Christmas. Shove a wand in her hand, half a yard of tinsel round her, she'll be well away.
And then, the carolers appear. Like something straight out of a Giles cartoon. I used to love Giles cartoons when I was a kid. Because my nan used to have a load of the Giles books, and I was thoroughly enchanted by Grandma Giles as a sort of an old rat bag of a granny.
Oh, three little boys, all out, and with a little lantern. Oh, aren't they sweet?
Oh, dear, look at them, straight out of a Giles cartoon. quick, get back, they're coming up the path.
What newspaper was that? Was that Daily Express? Or?
Yes, Express, wasn't it? Yeah, I was going to say the Express.
Yeah.
Because I think it was on from, well, late 40s or after the war, right through, well, till I don't know how recently, but it's...
Until he died in the 90s, I think. Yeah. Something like that.
I know it was in there for a long time.
There's a statue of Grandma Giles somewhere near the seafront where he lived, which I think is somewhere in this neck of the woods. And then, of course, you have the joy of Alan Simpson, his little cameo role, calling him, "Oh, you old fat rotter!" In the highest pitched voice I've heard coming from Alan Simpson. So we heard him very gruff in a previous one, didn't we? As the Bureau, but this white time he's using the opposite end of his range.
Go on, sling it up, clear off.
Give us some money, you old fat rotter!
Who's a fat rotter?
You are!
How dare you! Get off my land before I have one of my turns!
I was just going to say, this is the end of the range you hear more frequently, isn't it? The high-pitched Alan voice.
Yeah, it is. And I had a look at the script because, of course, there are three carol singers, one of whom is Kenneth, and the other one is Ray.
Yeah.
Which I wasn't sure who the third one was, but yeah, the other one is Ray. So Ray doesn't get, I don't know how many times he appeared. It wasn't that often.
It was a handful, I think.
There's no one coming. Let's chuck a brick through the window.
You dare. What do you want?
Oh, swipe me. What do we want? We've been standing out here in the freezing bitter doing our jolly old nut.
Yeah, this is, you know, nice to have Ray as part of the...
There aren't any adult guest stars this week, are there? It's only the children, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so.
So you've got the regulars, plus you've got the boy and the girl, but you haven't got any adult additional cast members, so any other voices you hear are going to be Alan or Ray, aren't they?
That's right, yes.
Yeah.
So when the carol singers turn up, they say, Kenneth Williams says, "Oh, that's £18 we've got so far tonight."
It's quite a lot of money.
It's £18 tonight. I told you it was a better racket than paper rounds. I think we'll make this the last one.
All right.
We'll do Good King Wenceslas in C sharp.
And as you know, I like to get my inflation calculator out. That works out about £500 tonight. That's not bad for not carol singing, is it?
Definitely better than a paper round.
Lucrative business. But the way that they just sing Good King Wenceslas, right, that's enough.
Yeah, that's fantastic, isn't it?
The cut-off of that is great.
Yeah.
But the way they build it up and say you've got to sing it with feeling and then it's just three words.
Yeah.
Now remember, no gabbling, it's a Christmas carol, so put warmth and sincerity into every word. Uh-huh. As though we really meant it.
Yes.
Right. 1, 2, 3.
Good King Wenceslas.
That's enough.
The interesting thing I found in this one is there's a line, because they're exchanging insults, beery nose, claret conch.
Yeah. Claret conch.
Clear off, I'll set the dogs on you.
Beery nose.
Oh, fat legs.
Four eyes.
Wooden face.
Spotty neck.
Oh, come in. Grown man shouting down the street at little children.
Well, did you hear what they were calling me? Oh, fat legs, pudding face, and beery nose. My worst enemy couldn't say I was a beery nose. I didn't get this nose from beer. If they'd said claret conch, they would have been nearer the mark.
And this Tony calls him spotty neck. And then the line that was always cut on previous versions I'd heard of it growing up, you know, on cassette tapes and things, where he's going on about, you know, well, that, you know, that's calling him spotty neck. You know, they'll all be calling him that down at the playground. You know, their mother too will spread it round.
I got me home back, though. That little one didn't like it when I called him spotty neck. That struck home. Soft spot with him, I shouldn't wonder. Those other two will put it around. That'll be his name for life now.
And that bit is been, I think, reinstated from another source, or it's just in the longer edit. But for years, that line, I think there's another one somewhere in the episode, were newer to me when I re-listened to the CD release, I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago, which is quite nice.
This episode was repeated on Boxing Day 1971. And according to our friend Roger Wilmot, that was an shortened version that went out on that occasion, edited down to 26 minutes or something.
Yeah.
I wonder if that was the transcription services edit then that they used, because this one was was edited for overseas.
Oh, right.
Re-edited again later, probably, down to a shorter time.
That's right. I was just going to say that's three words for the carol, so for the, you know, the Good King Wenceslas, and I think Hancock mentions Izzy Bourne.
Oh, yes.
Which was a good cultural reference.
I was just scrabbling around to remember that.
We've entertained you with our carol.
Bob, for three words. Izzy Bond doesn't get paid at that rate.
But I looked him up, and there was lots on there about he did, I mean, hundreds and hundreds of radio broadcasts. He did variety bandbox. He was a theatrical agent in the 1950s. But I couldn't see anything that talked about him being especially well paid that would prompt that line. I don't know if anyone else found anything else about him.
No, not particularly. I mean, I know he was, he released quite a few records, so maybe it's just because he was known for selling records, like you would say, I don't know, Tom Jones, maybe.
I dreamed that I was home for Christmas, and I heard the carol singers down the lane.
I think he was known for sort of his humorous sketches and that sort of thing, wasn't he, as well? And it said, he became a theatrical agent, produced variety shows. So no doubt there was quite a lot of income from that. But couldn't see anything that said he was well paid for appearing on radio shows and things. But so it was an interesting cultural reference, that one.
Mm. There's an instance here, isn't there, where the audience get a bit excited and Hancock has to go, please, please, to get them to calm down a bit.
Yes.
Yeah, and it's...
When they think of him not having his hair cut since he was 14.
Oh, yes. Yeah, there is quite a reaction to that, isn't there? This idea of him with this long, long hair. Yeah.
It's kind of asking for it, really, isn't it?
Yeah, it's one of those sort of things of the character of, if she had me dressing in the velvet suits till I was, 27.
Well, not like them anyway. I was a little picture. me velvet suit, me curly hair. I didn't have it cut till I was 14. Me little... Please. Me little button-up shoes and a hoop and a stick.
I think, isn't there a line from his real life where he used to joke, I was with my mother on a train and she said, oh, look at the choo-choo. And I was 27 at the time or something like that.
Yeah.
So, that's quite a good one. And then you get to the entrance of Sid doing the Good King Wenceslas as well.
Yes.
I can't remember the tune.
No, it's a different one, wasn't it?
God rest you merry gentlemen.
No, he says Good King Wenceslas. He sings that
to me. It's the same one.
Yeah.
Is it?
No, wait a minute. I recognise that voice. It's Sydney.
It can't be. He's standing out there in short trousers and school cap. That's him. He's on the fiddle again.
But I felt he paints a really good picture of Sid with his short trousers on.
Yes.
Great airy things with bumps on them.
Yeah.
Come off it, Sid. The short trousers aren't fooling anybody. I'd recognise those legs anywhere. Great airy things with bumps on them.
Does paint a good picture.
I love the line where he says, I'm just after finding a few coppers for Christmas. He said, I'll find a few with helmets on in a minute, which is...
that's one of my favourite lines in the whole programme.
It's
love
great,
that
isn't it?
No, I'm just trying to find a few coppers for Christmas. I'll find a few with helmets on if you don't clear off.
But in the original script, there's a bit more to that section. And Sid talks about him, he's penniless. Tony says, I sense some cunningly contrived roguery in the air. I'm going in and going to bolt the door. And Sid says, I've struck hard times this Christmas. I slunk all my money into holly and mistletoe. And what happens? We get a sudden warm spell. The glue melts and all the berries fall off. Mm-hmm. So I've come down to this carol singing. Brilliant little extra piece, probably cut at rehearsal.
There's a wonderfully performed line by him, Tony, where he's saying, well, you can all hang your bells on a telegraph pole and have a whale of a time.
Look, if I hear one more word about kids, decorations and Christmas, I'm kicking you all out in the street. Then you can hang your balloons and bells on a telegraph pole and have the time of your lives.
Again, it's sort of that very Scroogey thing, and the allocation of people in different rooms. Like, you're out in the doghouse with Sid and everything like that. Yeah.
And Hancock's in the bath.
Now, the little boy is in Mr. Hancock's room.
He is not. He is on the piano stool.
He's in your room. I moved all your stuff out.
Well, you can move it all back again. I'm not sleeping on the landing.
I know you're not. You're in the bath.
I am not. I refuse. That tap drips. I'll get me boots wet.
Well, don't sleep in your boots.
I always sleep in my boots. There might be a fire.
Don't sleep in your boots. What if there were a fire?
And when Sid comes back in, I just love it when he hears you're in the dog kennel, and he goes, right, I'll put the decorations up. Where are we going to put the mistletoe? He goes, well, like we're sitting in a doghouse, weren't it?
Yes.
Well, where do I sleep and what do I eat? In the dog kennel, 2 Polish eggs and 1/2 a spud. All right, then. Well, I tell you what, I'll come in and put up the decorations, all the balloons and paper chains and tinsel. That's going to look a bit silly in the dog kennel, isn't it?
It's just so well delivered.
It is, isn't it?
Every single line in this episode is brilliant. Do you prefer, if you sort of take the Christmas episodes, the Christmas-themed episode, how do you feel this one stands up to the others?
For me personally, I think this is the best of the Christmas episodes.
I do,
Christmas Club comes second for me.
I noticed on Twitter there's quite a few people, actually, when we said we were doing Hancock's Happy Christmas, they all reference Turkey Feet and Chips, which is actually the wrong episode, but that's more synonymous with Hancock and Christmas, isn't it? Turkey Feet and Chips.
Possibly.
Yes.
Yeah, I think what we did on Twitter, we asked them what their favourite Hancock Christmas episode was, and then their favourite line. So I think the favourite lines were coming from all the Christmas episodes. But I think the Turkey Feet and Chips, which is from the Christmas Club, isn't it? Was certainly a very popular one. And I think they all got quite a lot of votes, as it were. The other thing that people mentioned was, of course, the knock on the door scene in the Christmas Club, which, of course, we did that episode as a Christmas special last year. But, I think there are a lot of classic scenes in the other one. But I actually prefer this one, like Martin. And one of the reasons I like this is that it's got Hattie in it and Bill. Yeah. And I think it just makes it that little bit more special.
I think so. And I think the children being in it as well. I mean, I know we've talked about their brilliant performance.
Yeah.
And they really are superb in this.
I think so.
And
yeah.
I think the kids being in it as well just give it a real extra lift, which for me makes it, well, it's definitely my favourite one of the Christmas episodes.
Well, I think this and Bill and Father Christmas are two of the more hilarious, I think, of the Christmas ones. There's not that many that exist. Of course, there were others that are missing her and Cox re-recorded, which are lost. But there's more lost Christmas episodes than there are existing ones, on balance, something like that.
Yes.
I would think so. Could there work?
Well, they did 3 in Series 1, didn't they?
I'd say there were a lot of Christmas episodes in Series 1. Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, you get in this one things like the greeting to the vicar. My word, Vicky, you nearly had an overcoat full of ting tacks there, which I'm sure that joke was reused in a Steptoe, you know, when you had that chap playing the vicar in repeatedly in that show. Almost exactly word for word.
More carol singers. Where's me shotgun? I'll spray him with buckshot. What do you want?
Good evening, brethren.
Oh. Oh, hello, Vicar. I my word, you nearly had an overcoat full of Tintex then.
I do enjoy whenever, you know, no matter how sort of angry or pent up he is, as soon as a vicar comes up, oh, hello, Vicar. How he sort of reveres him so much and just completely collapses.
Fawning kind of behaviour.
Yeah.
Well, definitely. Yeah. And doesn't Kenneth Williams play a brilliant vicar?
Oh, he does. You can picture him, can't you, as well?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, the voice just goes with being a vicar. It's just brilliant.
Quite similar to his Felix Aylmer Judge sort of voice, isn't it, really? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
We really do appreciate what you're doing.
What am I doing?
It's not everyone who can so kindly open their home and their hearts at Christmas time to 2 12-year-old orphans.
Who, me? Kids? In this house? No, I don't think so. You've made a mistake. Kids are allergic to me. Every time they come within a few yards of me, they come out in bruises, you know. It's a strange thing.
Well, we've been chatting on for a bit here, chaps, and we've still got lots more to do. What about we come back next time and finish this off?
Sounds good to me.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds a good idea, Tim.
So we'll be back with the news and scores in a fortnight. So take it away, Tim.
Why not join the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society today, or buy a gift subscription for the Hancock fan in your life? It's not too late for Christmas. You can find us at tonyhancock.org.uk for all the information on how to join.
For just £13 a year, you'll have access to the members area of our website and receive 4 magazines a year by email packed with information on Tony, his shows and archive material.
Members also get a digital-only bonus pages supplement every quarter.
Or you can have full-colour printed copies of The Missing Page posted to your door for £16 in the UK or £26 worldwide.
And we are a friendly and welcoming bunch, so please do join. We have reunion events with archive displays and video screenings.
Please do get in touch. We love questions, conundrums and feedback. To do so is very easy. Send your emails to podcast@tonyhancock.org.uk.
Keep an eye on our Twitter accounts for the latest news on the podcast and all things Tony Hancock. Our Twitter accounts are East Team Lad, Tony Hancock Appreciation Society and Very Nearly an Armful.
Next time we'll have part 2 of our review of Hancock's Happy Christmas. Hope to see you in a couple of weeks. In the meantime, don't forget to rate, review and subscribe for forthcoming episodes.
For now, that's Very Nearly an Armful, so I'll say ta-ta.
It's sayonara from me.
Chickadee Stitch.
And this is GLK London signing off for a quick coffin a drag.
Right, that's it. I'm off for my tan a bar of chocolate. That'll last me 2 or 3 days, that will.
This has been an official podcast of the Tony Hancock Appreciation Society. Unfortunately, it was not written by Alan Simpson and Ray Gordon, whoever they are. The announcer was me, Robin Sebastian, currently appearing in the saloon bar of the Hand and Racket.
We are not having a tree. Horrible, messy things. And you have to knock them and you've got showers of green needles all over the place. I've only got to come running down in my rope sandals one morning, I'll have feet like pincushions.
So, yes, that's good.
Another good and runny.
Another good bummer.
Another good and runny.